Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland Public Affairs Programming. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Today is April 13th, 2009, and in the studio with me today is the co-founder of String Theory, Dr. Michio Kaku. Thank you for being here, Dr. Kaku.
Glad to be on the show.
You may have encountered Michio Kaku's image on a major news interview program like 2020 or on the Science Channel, and soon he'll appear on your TV as host of a three-part series, Visions of the Future. Dr. Kaku's books are required reading at major physics labs, but we're here today to discuss one of his New York Times bestseller books for general readership, Physics of the Impossible. Dr. Kaku, you are one of the few working physicists who evidently has the energy to address the general public as well, and you have great success in doing so, not only on television programs, but through your best-selling books like Hyperspace and Parallel Worlds. Physics of the Impossible, your new book, has a wonderfully inspiring effect, and even at my age, it arouses great curiosity about your categories of Class 1, Class 2, and Class 3 impossibilities. Could you explain these categories?
Yes. Usually when a scientist says, bah, humbug, that's impossible. You can't have UFOs that come from alien galaxies or invisibility or teleportation. You have to take a look at a bigger question. Are they possible in the future? Class 1 impossibilities are impossibilities that may actually be possible in the coming decades, like invisibility, force fields, hover cars, teleportation. Then you have Class 2 impossibilities that are really out there, like time travel. We think they are possible, but they may take centuries for us to build a time machine. And then you have Class 3 impossibilities, which simply are downright impossible.
And you have that's a very small category for you. You poo-poo only, let's see, what is it, precognition and violation of the laws of thermodynamics, I think.
That's right. I mean, I was shocked to find that when I listed all the gadgets you see on Star Trek or Star Wars, all of them, lightsabers and starships and stuff like that, the only things which seem to violate all known laws of physics include, for example, getting a free lunch, violating the conservation of matter and energy. But besides just a handful, almost everything can, in fact, be realized in the coming decades. And that's why I wrote the book, to inspire young people to realize that, hey, in your lifetime, you will see many of these technologies come to fruition because we physicists are building them.
I realized through reading your book that the category of precognition is one which automatically discards the idea of parallel universes, which I certainly had not thought about it in that frame. That's just one of the aspects of the book that caught my attention. The Physics of the Impossible uses science fiction ideas to illuminate the potentials of modern and future physics, the force fields in Star Trek and other sci-fi fantasies are, you say, a Class 1 impossibility. But you say that the 19th century scientist Faraday anticipated them. Could you elaborate? And what is a plasma window?
Okay, well, first of all, when you take a look at force fields, you think that, wow, it should be possible to build a force field tomorrow. Actually, force fields are very difficult to create. We have four known forces, electricity and magnetism, which lights up our cities, gravity, which keeps you on your floor. We have the two nuclear forces, which lights up the sun. But a force field that's paper thin that would protect your starship is actually quite difficult to build. However, at the Brookhaven National Laboratories, a physicist invented the first working force field that will do what is done in Star Trek. In Star Trek, they have the shuttle bay door. They have a window that separates the inside of the Enterprise from the outside. And so you don't need an airlock. You don't need these cumbersome devices to protect the vacuum of space from the insides of your spaceships. We've done that now. A plasma window, a wall of ionized particles will, in fact, separate the inside from the outside. That's been done now.
It's been done, but I have to ask you, if I put my hand through a plasma window, won't it get quick fried to a crackly crunch?
Yeah, you don't want to get too close to a plasma window. And as you pointed out, we're filming this. Every chapter of the book will be made into a 12-episode series for the Science Channel in fall. And we actually interviewed the guy who invented the plasma window, and we actually photographed it. So you'll see what a plasma window would look like, which in the future will protect your shuttle bay door from the rigors of outer space.
What?
But a real force field, however, would require new technologies. For example, lasers and nanotubes. A very thin wall of nanotubes will, in fact, replicate most of the features of a force field.
Yes, I remember reading that in the book that you mentioned a three-layered force field with nanotubes And let's see, what else?
Laser beams.
Laser beams.
A crisscross pattern of laser beams and, of course, a plasma window. So the plasma window and the laser beams and carbon nanotubes together would be sufficient to create a force field. But force fields are much more difficult to create than you think, but the foundations for a force field have been laid already.
Carbon nanotubes come up here and there in the book, and you mentioned them in the context of a space elevator as well.
That's right. Remember Jack and the Beanstalk, who rode this beanstalk to heaven? Believe it or not, that's consistent with the laws of physics. If you have a ball and a string, the ball does not fall down because of centrifugal force. So if you have a wire or a beanstalk to heaven, it doesn't fall down because centrifugal force will keep it afloat. Now, normally we think that it would break. That's why this space elevator does not exist, because the wire would break. But now with carbon nanotubes, we can now create fibers stronger than steel. They are the strongest fibers known to science, in fact. Tough, much tougher than steel, and they can, in fact, we think, be used to build a space elevator. So one day, when you want to go into outer space, you simply hit the up button of an elevator.
The up and up and up button.
Yeah, no booster rockets, no space suit. You just hit the up button of an elevator, and off you go.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to that. Your book also makes fascinating asides about the history of science, about Newton, for example, who you describe as a possible Asperger's-type personality, like some other famous scientists, and there's a relation there to Stephen Hawking. Could you discuss that?
Many biographies of Newton, perhaps the greatest scientist who ever lived, even Einstein would have said that, say that he was a very strange fellow. He didn't have any close friends. He was pathologically incapable of small talk. You would not want to invite him to dinner, for example. And everyone just thought he was kind of a nasty loner. But now we believe that he was suffering from Asperger's syndrome, which is a mild form of autism. We know about autistic savants who can rattle off tremendous mathematical abilities. I once interviewed one of them. He can recite the number pi to about 20,000 decimal places. It takes him several days to do this, just to recite the digits of pi, but he can do it. And it's been checked by computer.
And his mom, I'll bet.
And we think that Newton had a mild form of it. These people are functional. They are mathematical geniuses, and several Nobel Prize winners and Fields medalists, we think, also suffered from Asperger's. And again, they're kind of odd people. You don't want to have them out for dinner, but they have these fantastic mathematical skills, and they tend to win the Nobel Prize.
And Stephen Hawking has the same chair as Isaac Newton. That's a fascinating...
The Lucasian chair, right? And I once visited Stephen Hawking's home. There are many devices in his home that allow him to, for example, turn the page of a book by simply pushing a button, and then there's a mechanical device that grabs a page and turns it. Unfortunately, today, Stephen can't do that anymore. He's lost even control of his vocal cords. He basically communicates with the world via his eyeballs. By moving his eyes, that's how he communicates with the world today.
My goodness.
So you can imagine the sheer mathematical and personal tour de force that's required for him to communicate and do physics and do mathematics by moving his eyes. Try that sometime.
No, thanks. that is inspiring, and one of the aspects, well, probably the primary aspect of the book is that it inspires such curiosity, and it seems to me that you are... trying to inspire a new generation very effectively, I think, with taking these fantastic ideas from science fiction. If I could, I would put your book in junior high and high school libraries so that, you know, those science nerd kids could just get their jets fired with it. Have you had much experience? Have you had feedback from kids reading the book?
I get a lot of feedback from kids who are inspired by reading the books. And when I was a kid, I remember that I was just glued to the TV screen watching Flash Gordon. And every week, I began to experience a whole new universe out there. However, very quickly, I realized that I didn't have blonde hair, I didn't have blue eyes, I didn't have muscles. But it was the scientist who made the whole series work. So I was hooked. It was the scientist who built the starship, the scientist who built the ray guns, the city in the sky, of which George Lucas stole and put into his movie, the Star Wars series. And so I began to realize that science is what makes the universe move. And young kids can learn it. And that's one reason why I write these books, for young people and also the young at heart. people who are maybe in their 80s, but have always wondered whether or not you can make an object invisible or whether a starship can take us to the stars.
When I was reading the book, I was actually inspired to to take a different view of mathematics. And anyone who knows me well knows how, well, that's practically impossible right there. I always hated mathematics and viewed it as drudgery. But after reading about Newton, after reading about string theory, I realized that I didn't have the tools. And I began to look at mathematics as in some way that I would look at, say, a reliable car that would take me, for example, here in Oregon. If you have a car that will go for a couple of hours, you can go to wonderful and isolated places that are very satisfying. It's your tool.
Right.
So if you have to work on your car, then that's okay.
And the mathematics is a tool, and what you are building, we think, is music. We think the language of the universe at the most fundamental level is music, the music of tiny vibrating strings. And so the melodies played on these tiny vibrating strings create all the subatomic particles and all the chemistry that we see. The universe, we think, is a symphony of strings. And we think the string theory will allow us to, quote, read the mind of God. That's the phrase used by Einstein in search for a theory of everything. He wanted one equation, perhaps no more than 1 inch long, that would allow him to probe the deepest secrets of nature and unify everything. Well, today, string theory is the leading and only candidate for a theory of everything. And we now have a candidate for the mind of God. The mind of God would be cosmic music resonating through 11-dimensional hyperspace.
Okay, well, we'll just have a moment of silence and think about... No, I'm kidding about that. no silence here on the radio. Well, I think I'll ask you about parallel universes then. You bring up Schrodinger's cat, unresolved quantum paradox, wave versus particle, that sort of thing. But you also mentioned the new ability to isolate individual atoms. The debate is fascinating. Could you explain the relation of the question to that of parallel universes?
Quantum mechanics is the most successful theory proposed in the history of mankind. I realized that laser beams, transistors, the internet, this phone conversation, radio transmissions, everything is based on tiny vibrating electrons. And when you learned about electrons in high school, remember your high school teacher drew these footballs on the blackboard and said these footballs represent electrons. Well, your high school teacher didn't want to upset you. He didn't want you to freak out. He didn't tell you what these footballs were. These footballs are really electrons being many places at the same time. They exist in parallel universes, just like in Twilight Zone. So how is it that we cannot be two places at the same time? We are large objects, and so these vibrations sort of cancel each other out. But at the subatomic level, electrons exist in parallel states, they exist in parallel universes. They dart in and out of parallel universes. We are large, so it's quite difficult for us to do it, like an elephant going through the eye of a needle. But at the very fundamentals of physics, we do think there are parallel universes, just like in the Twilight Zone.
Paul Steinhardt at Princeton apparently dislikes the anthropic principle that implies the idea of several universes as desperate, and says in his essay in the collection, What We Believe But Cannot Prove, that a simple universe demands a simple explanation, but is there such a unifying idea, or are we one electron?
Well, the electron exists in many parallel states, and once upon a time, the universe was smaller than an electron. So if an electron exists in many parallel states, the universe must also, we think, exist in many parallel states. And string theory also seems to go in that direction. String theory, which we think is the theory of everything, has many possible universes in terms of solutions of the equations, and we call this the multiverse. The multiverse is the infinite number of possible universes, sort of like taking a bubble bath. Each bubble of a bubble bath represents a universe. They are expanding. We live on the skin of one of these bubbles, but these bubbles bump into each other, and they coexist with other bubbles. And we think that is the basic picture of where the Big Bang came from. The Big Bang probably came from a collision between bubbles or between the fissioning of two bubbles. So we think that a bubble bath is the proper paradigm to describe the universe. And for me, that's very nice because my parents are Buddhists and I was raised as a Christian. In Christianity, you have a Genesis when Charlton Heston says, let there be light. And in Buddhism, you have nirvana, a state of nothingness where there is no beginning, there is no end. Now the multiverse idea combines Buddhism with Judeo-Christian thinking because we think that Big Bangs happen all the time. we have this ocean of nirvana called 11-dimensional hyperspace, which is unstable and bubbles form. Then these big bangs are nothing but Genesis within nirvana.
Genesis within nirvana. Okay. Live in the studio here at KBOO Portland, we have Dr. Michio Kaku, co-discoverer, co-founder of string theory. I guess that's how you say it, co-founder. And we're talking about Physics of the Impossible, and let me see if I can find the full... What's the full title of Physics of the Impossible?
I don't have it here.
Oh, here we are. A Scientific Exploration into the World of Phasers, Force Fields, Teleportation, and Time Travel. It's published under the Anchor imprint for Random House. I would subtitle it Endless Fun, because I really enjoyed reading it. Tell me about invisibility. This is one of the class one, invisibilities.
It's coming very fast.
Impossibilities.
Right.
What's happening with this?
Well, for the TV series, we went to Berkeley, where I got my PhD, and interviewed the physicists who are making objects invisible, just like in Harry Potter. Now, it's at the microscopic scale. We cannot make, for example, a table or a house invisible yet, but the principle has been demonstrated now. Now, this is rather embarrassing because when I teach optics to my students, I used to teach them that invisibility was impossible, that it violated the laws of optics. Well, I was wrong, and so was every single physics textbook on the planet Earth. We were all wrong. All of us assumed that when you look at glass or water, that you have a uniform medium and light cannot bend backwards in a uniform medium. However, if the medium is irregular, we missed that. We had this loophole that we didn't see clearly. You have what are called metamaterials that have impurities in them. These impurities will, in fact, make light go bend backwards.
Metamaterials.
Think of a boulder in a river. Water flows around the bubble, around the boulder, so that downstream you think that there is no boulder upstream. It's invisible. You can't detect it. In the same way, light, we think, could not wrap around an object like Harry Potter and reform at the other end. That violated the laws of optics. Wrong. We now realize that light can, in fact, bend around Harry Potter and make him invisible.
Okay, well, I'm trying to bend my brain around Harry Potter right now. It's not working too well, so I'll just change the topic. let's talk about optics then. Let's talk about Maxwell and time travel. One of the things that was fascinating to me, the idea that, it's a high-energy thing, apparently.
If you take a look at Einstein's equations, time is a river. It's a meandering river that speeds up and slows down, and we measure this every day. Our GPS systems, the internet, everything is dependent on Einstein's theory of relativity. Some people ask me the question, what has Einstein done for me lately? And the answer is, everything. Now, we think that the river of time also has whirlpools and forks into two rivers. Einstein himself realized that these were solutions of his equations. He had doubts about them. But now we find hundreds of solutions of Einstein's equations where you can go backwards in the past and meet your teenage mother before you're born. And if your teenage mother falls in love with you, you're in deep doo-doo. So, well, what would it take to build one of these things? It would take the energy of a black hole. Don't think that any inventor tonight is going to announce from his basement that he's invented a time machine. A DeLorean can't do it. It would take the energy of a star, basically, to warp the fabric of space and time. And then the question is, what happens if you do meet your teenage mother before you're born? What do you do in a situation like that? Can you alter your past? Can you change the world line of the universe?
Which brings us slipping into parallel universes, I suppose.
That's right. And we think that the river of time forks into two rivers, and a parallel universe is created such that you can alter somebody else's Abraham Lincoln and prevent him from being assassinated at the Ford Theater. But your Abraham Lincoln did die. Your past cannot be changed. Your parents did give birth to you. But in principle, you can monkey around with other universes. Now, there's a TV program called Sliders, which came out years ago. In the very first episode of Sliders, a young boy reads a book and falls asleep and has this dream of building a sliding machine. Well, that book is my book, Hyperspace. So my book, Hyperspace, actually gave birth to a TV program.
Awesome. I remember the jokes that Terry Pratchett made about the bifurcation of the trousers of time, taking that to a different sort of metaphor. Your presentation of the possibility or impossibility of starships, which I think that's a class two, right? points out how inadequate our chemical fuel rockets are for the task. But there follows a fascinating exposition of everything from ion rockets to ramjet fusion. And before reading the book, I had no idea that so much work had been done on this. The weird history of U.S. nuclear rocket research, the Timberwind program, nanoships. Please talk about that.
Okay, well, as I mentioned, the book is going to be filmed for a 12-episode TV series in fall on the Science Channel. Just 3 days ago, I was in Cleveland, Ohio, interviewing some of the NASA scientists who very seriously are laying the groundwork for starships. And again, this is maybe 100 years away, so you're not going to be able to blast off like Captain Kirk anytime soon. But we do think that plasma engines will take us to Pluto and Jupiter and the outer planets. Much more powerful than chemical rockets of today. Chemical rockets only blast off for 4 minutes, and that's it. 4 minutes, and it's over. Plasma engines will go on for months, years. And so we think that plasma engines will take us to Pluto. Beyond that, however, you have to go to solar sails, ramjet fusion engines that gobble up hydrogen in the forward direction. Think of an ice cream cone that scoops up hydrogen as it moves in space and then burns it. That's a ramjet fusion engine, and that'll run forever. An engine that will literally head toward the speed of light because it runs forever. So we interviewed scientists who work on the solar sail, ramjet fusion engines, and even antimatter engines. But my favorite, though, is the warp drive. That, of course, is class two now. Now you're talking about hundreds of years into the future. But we have several designs now for a warp drive engine, somewhat similar to the Star Trek engines. There was a physicist in Mexico, Professor Alcubierre, who was watching the Star Trek series and said, well, why can't I find a solution of Einstein's equations which give you the warp drive of the TV program? And he found the solution. To my knowledge, this is one of the first times where science fiction actually gave birth to real science. And we physicists are studying it. I just interviewed him a few days ago for the TV series. And, of course, it takes the energy of a star to propel it, so don't think we're going to be able to build it anytime soon. But it seems to be within the laws of physics. There is a loophole in Einstein's equations.
And in that category, you mentioned such bizarre things, an actual program to examine the possibility of setting off hydrogen bombs to fuel a spaceship.
Yeah, well, the military, of course, would like to use hydrogen bombs for everything, including starships. They tried to promote what is called the nuclear rocket program, which was a total failure. Rockets kept melting down. Can you imagine having a meltdown in orbit? It'd be a horror, it'd be a nightmare. And so the military is still chugging along, you know, tinkering with atomic rockets. But the Orion craft was a device that would actually ride on a wave of explosions from hydrogen bombs. You would drop mini hydrogen bombs from the exhaust. Each hydrogen bomb would push you in the forward direction, and you would approach half the speed of light with the spacecraft. One of the designers of the project was actually an acquaintance of mine, and he quit. He actually refused to work on it. So I asked him once, this guy was one of the designers of our nuclear arsenal. He actually designed the world's largest atomic bomb for the Pentagon, and he was the biggest promoter of the Starship based on nuclear weapons. I asked him, why did you stop? And he realized that one day a terrorist may be able to create a mini hydrogen bomb that you could put inside a small briefcase.
Oops.
And at that point, he said, oh my God, I'm building the weapons of doomsday. And he quit. He quit for philosophical, political reasons.
All right for him.
Yeah, he said, I'm not going to work on this anymore. I refuse to work on this thing anymore.
Well, speaking of research, I want to ask you, what's the short-term future of high-energy physics research at the Large Hadron Collider? And do you think that it can find the Higgs boson or its remnants? Does it have sufficient funding?
Well, as most people know now, there is a machine which some people say will blow up the Earth when it's turned on this summer outside Geneva, Switzerland. Well, I don't think so. Its purpose is to create particles that we hope would be higher vibrations of the string. And we hope dark matter and other exotic forms of matter would be created by the machine. If you take a look at the energy of the machine, it creates particles that have energy less than a fruit fly. Therefore, it is harmless. People are not afraid of fruit flies, and people should not be afraid of the Large Hadron Collider. Our bodies are hit with cosmic rays that are more powerful than anything that this puny pea shooter can create. Mother Nature, when Mother Nature's angry, slams black holes together and creates particles much more ferocious than anything that we puny humans can create. So there's nothing to worry about when the Large Hadron Collider is turned on this summer. However, next month, Tom Hanks stars in a movie where this same accelerator is used to blow up the Vatican. Well, that's not going to happen. It's Hollywood hype, basically.
Do you think the recently imagined proton-driven plasma Wakefield collider will substantially reduce costs?
We hope so. We hope to have a generation of what are called tabletop accelerators. It's still basically in the planning stages. We cannot simply create these bigger and bigger machines. The Large Hadron Collider is 27 miles in circumference. It is bigger than the city of Geneva. You could put Geneva inside the machine and you wouldn't even notice it. That's how big the machine is. And sooner or later, we're going to have to build machines with the new technology. And the purpose of the machine is not to destroy the world. The purpose of the machine is to recreate a piece of Genesis. We want to recreate a mini Big Bang that's harmless in the laboratory to understand how the universe was created.
You're listening to KBOO Radio. I'm Teresa Mitchell, and I'm speaking with the co-founder of String Theory, Dr. Michio Kaku, who's in the studios today. Well, let me ask you finally about weaponry again. What about the Death Star? Is that ever going to be possible? And, you know, and I guess I want to preface that with, gee, I hope not.
Well, Jay, I hope not. When I was in high school, my advisor was Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb. He helped to get me a scholarship to Harvard, and he really wanted me to work on hydrogen warheads. He made a very strong pitch for me to work.
He was all about that.
He made a very strong pitch for me to work at Livermore or Los Alamos National Laboratory designing hydrogen warheads. I said no, because I wanted to work on an even bigger explosion, and that is the Big Bang. That is the creation of the universe itself. So a Death Star, we think, may be possible. It may be possible to blow up an entire planet, just like on Star Wars, but it would have to be naturally occurring. A Death Star would be a gamma ray burster, a black hole in formation. And there's actually one headed our way. We have to watch out for this one. It's called WR104. You can Google it tonight. WR104 is a double star system that's unstable, 8,000 light years from Earth. If it ever blows up, and it's pointed at us, by the way, it could wipe out all life on Earth.
With a gamma ray burst?
With a gamma ray burst. 8,000 years ago, baby, it already blew up. In which case, the radiation will reach us tomorrow. You're doing your laundry tomorrow, and you look up in the sky, and you see the sky's on fire. Well, that's within the laws of physics. We're monitoring it carefully. Most physicists are not so worried about it because it probably will miss us, but not by much. But it is pointed in our direction, and you can see it tonight by going to WR104 when you Google it.
Oh, great. Well, I've been speaking with Professor Michio Kaku, co-founder of Spring Theory, holder of the Henry Semmett Chair in Professorship in Theoretical Physics at the City College in New York, author of Physics of the Impossible, a scientific exploration at the world of phasers, force fields, teleportation, and time travel. Going to be at Powell's Books tonight downtown at 7:30. And so be there or be Hadrons. And thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure.